This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, September 28th, 2020. I'm Caleb Brown. Amy Coney Barrett of the Seventh Circuit is Donald Trump's pick to replace the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court. What does her relatively large body of work indicate about her predisposition if confirmed? Casey Maddox is Vice President for Legal and Judicial Strategy at Americans for Prosperity. We spoke yesterday.
I think the best answer about where she is philosophically is you begin with what she says about where she is philosophically, and then you check that against her actual jurisprudence. So you begin there. What she says about herself philosophically is that she is in the mold of Justice Scalia, that his philosophy is her philosophy. Obviously Justice Scalia had some important shifts, I think, over his time on the bench. But if you look at that, especially his later years and when she clerked with him on, I think that demonstrates a judicial philosophy that is pretty rooted in an originalist understanding of the Constitution, trying to seek to understand the text and its original public meaning at the time the Constitution was enacted, looking at the specific text of legislation that Congress enacted and how that was generally understood when it was written. And I think effectively what that does is it puts the burden on the legislature. It tells the Congress that it's your job to create the laws. You draft these things. We're going to apply these things to the best of our ability, instead of Congress essentially punting that job over to the Supreme Court and asking them to make the difficult decision. So I think that you begin with what she says, and then from there you can look at specific opinions. And you have cases like the gun rights case, the felon gun rights case, where that's going to be a controversial opinion, I'm sure, probably in a lot of ways. But the most notable thing is how she approaches that with a mindset to understand what the Second Amendment meant at the time. And I think if you apply that same sort of framework to other issues, and we have every indication that she would, that's a pretty rooted constitutionalist philosophy.
So in some sense, you suspect that Judge Barrett will not have very much time for Congress writing vague laws or delegating vague authorities to administrative agencies?
Well, I say that I certainly hope so, and it seems that way from her jurisprudence. I mean, you look at someone who takes that kind of approach, who looks at the text of the Constitution and tries to give it effect, is going to naturally come to the conclusion that it's Congress's job to be making laws, and Congress shouldn't be punting that responsibility over to administrative agencies. When you take a case like the Gundy case that the Supreme Court has had recently, where the non-delegation doctrine is up, the question essentially was whether Congress could put this pretty broad grant of power over to administrative agencies to decide, Department of Justice, to decide whether or not someone would be a sex offender under the law. And of course, that's a challenging emotional case, right? And it comes up with someone who the question is basically whether or not they should be labeled a sex offender or not. It's not a happy case. But the legal questions in that case are very, very important. And the court was split about whether or not to revive what's called the non-delegation doctrine. And what that does is it would tell the agencies, it's your job to decide to confine these agencies. If you want them applying the law as an executive branch agency, you need to tell them what law to apply. You don't give them a lot of leeway to make the law. And I think it's plausible to believe that someone with her philosophy, maybe someone who would have reined in the Department of Justice there, and effectively rein in Congress.
Now, on that note, the Affordable Care Act asks HHS to create all sorts of regulations. And that's one of the sort of flashpoints of her nomination, is whether or not she would be amenable to that law and the way it functions.
That's right. That is certainly going to be one of the main lines of attack against her. We've now had, how many cases have we had dealing with the Affordable Care Act at the Supreme Court? So it's obviously not a challenging argument to make that cases involving the Affordable Care Act could come before her if she's on the Supreme Court. At this point, you could bet on that, right? But you know, at the end of the day, a lot of the, and this goes for a lot of the objections that will be made about what the outcomes of her decisions will be. At the end of the day, even if the, you know, some of the fears are realized from people who would be concerned about some of her decisions, even if those fears are realized, all that does is tell the Congress that they need to do the difficult job of finding a bipartisan compromise, finding a way to be able to achieve the objectives that they want to achieve, and do it in a constitutionally appropriate way. And so it leaves the lawmaking to the lawmakers. It's feasible. Unfortunately, the history of that issue particularly has been one of one party control trying to make those decisions and the other party trying to come up with ways to sort of chip away at that. And, you know, I think it could very well be that if you put that burden back on Congress and it knows that there's no other way, no one else is going to come riding to the riding in and save you. It's your job to make the law. If you leave that to Congress, maybe things change and we actually get a better lawmaking branch.
Is there anything in her jurisprudence that tells you that she has any affection or disdain for completely invented court doctrines that don't seem to follow legislative text or intent?
Well, I'll give you one. And now this is with the caveat. So one of those is qualified immunity, or at least that is my hope from looking at her record. And I will say that, you know, all of this is with the caveat that if you were a lower court judge, to a large degree, I do not want lower court judges, even where I would agree with their decisions, deciding that they're going to set aside doctrines that the Supreme Court has created. We have inferior courts, and they're inferior for a reason. The Supreme Court makes the decisions. And so, you know, so when she's making decisions, you have to sort of read with a grain of salt to some degree that her decisions on the Seventh Circuit have been limited by what the Supreme Court has already done. With that said, you have certain judges who think of qualified immunity who seem to have no difficulty at all applying qualified immunity and allowing government actors, including the police, to not be held accountable for unconstitutional conduct. Judge Barrett, in just over 2 years on the bench, has demonstrated that that is not her. She has had several instances in which she has denied qualified immunity. And, you know, I think that is a very hopeful sign. A judge who is willing to say that some of the actions that have come before her are clearly inappropriate for law enforcement officers and others, and that they should be held accountable. And hopefully, if she has an opportunity on the Supreme Court, she would be an additional vote for reviewing that doctrine.
Courts are always playing catch up when it comes to government uses of technology to surveil or observe citizens. The whatever doctrines that courts create to deal with that, or whatever tests they create in order to deal with that, seem almost hopelessly outdated, even just a few years after those are put into place. Is there anything in her academic work or her opinions from the bench that give you a sense of where she might view the appropriateness of government surveillance?
Sure. Well, you certainly do have some positive signs from her on the Fourth Amendment. Her decision in United States versus Terry that cited it was unreasonable for police to assume that someone else who came to the door was actually providing the consent to search a suspect's residence. And you know, several other decisions that have been positive, I think, on Fourth Amendment grounds. And so I think that does give you hope that she, and you know, as I mentioned earlier, the qualified immunity views, she certainly is not bending over backward to try to sort of help law enforcement in these cases in ways that are at the leave people at the mercy of law enforcement to decide how the law is going to apply and ignore the Constitution. So I think that is a positive sign. And, you know, I think we'll have to see as she addresses more of those specific kind of questions exactly where she shakes out. But, you know, I think even just the recent cases from the court indicate that it's a pretty close split on those sorts of questions, as in Carpenter and others. So, but I think she has the potential of being an additional vote for a more restrained view of police officers, restraining them by the Constitution.
You wanted to make note of due process cases, in particular the case at Purdue University. What was that case about, and what did she have to say about it?
Sure. This is an important case, and it's one that is very likely going to be brought up, I'm sure, over the next several weeks. She wrote an opinion in a case coming from Purdue University, where Purdue, as many public universities do, or haven't in recent years, had a student who was charged with sexual assault. And Purdue's approach to that sexual assault claim was to have the alleged victim provide a statement. The victim never went before anyone who was trying to make a determination, including never actually had to confront the student, or the student never had an opportunity to confront her, and never even spoke to the people who ultimately made the decision. And it turned out that apparently at least two of the people who made the decision said that they never even read her full statement, that they simply based their decision about his guilt by a preponderance of the evidence based on her initial accusation. And so she wrote the opinion for the Seventh Circuit saying that this violated due process, that students in those circumstances are entitled to due process. And it's a significant opinion that has already had an effect on the law in other circuits. Of course, the Trump administration has now rescinded the rule that from the Obama administration that effectively required those sorts of kind of kangaroo courts on campus. But you know, again, I think that's another very positive sign. And if you kind of link that up with her broader jurisprudence on police officers, this is not someone who was bending over backward to provide due process to a student, but lacks that sort of approach to due process in criminal cases. It's consistent across those. Due process is important for everyone. And you know, just in the time she's been on the bench, she has opinions that demonstrate an understanding of that across those issues.
Casey Maddox is Vice President for Legal and Judicial Strategy at Americans for Prosperity. We spoke yesterday. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast anywhere you please, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.